You know, in those early days of my career, I was always, how do I need to behave? Almost like an imposter syndrome. And, you know, I'm much more comfortable in that character now. I found triathlon very vanilla. I'd sit in these press conferences and you'd hear athletes say, oh, you know, best of luck to everybody. I've tried the best I can. And I mean, tried the best you can. This is not participation medals at the, like, we're at the top of the top of the top here. If you find it offensive, boo-hoo. That's how I thought of things. This is kill or be killed. And any athlete that thinks their ass is going to age like wine is just stupid. Outwork everyone else. Because talent is not going to get you there. And that used to drive me. And my dad used to kick his ass, son. You know, like, I'd be like, oh, I'm going to, Dad. You know, like, there was definitely a chip on my shoulder in a sense, and it used to feed me that, you know, I'm going to take that off you. What separates the greats is a undenying hardness and belief that they're better than everyone. You think you can do better? What did you do, mate? Nothing. Exactly. Piss off. You're just a voice. You're just a noise. You're a talking head.
Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to join us for this face-to-face podcast. It's great to have you here. I guess the first thing I wanted to start with was I was just thinking about how to approach this interview. And I was like looking at your life.
Were you nervous?
Yeah, very nervous. But I was thinking former athlete, okay, world champion, multiple world champion, businessman, entrepreneur, family man. Like, how do you see yourself?
Jeez, that's a big question, isn't it? Straight out
of
the box.
We always start with the big one first.
That's a huge one. How do I see myself? Look, I feel like I'm very, very lucky. You know, I came from pretty modest upbringing in south of Sydney in Australia. And, you know, my mother was a school teacher and my father was a waterside worker. And he was very driven around pushing us to be educated. And so the whole thought at that point in my life when I was young that I'd ever be a professional athlete and travel the world and do things was like that I've done was just not even on my radar. My father was very home, bang, very strict upbringing, myself and my two brothers. And I think I've carried a lot of that discipline and that mindset that my father, at the time, I remember thinking my dad was like an ogre. I'm like, dude, why can't you be cool like everyone else's dad? And I think also, my father was a lot older than my mother. He was 14 years older than my mother. He was born in 1931, so he was definitely a different generation. And so I always thought I had the old dad. And like my friends' parents were listening to Led Zeppelin and cool bands, and my dad was listening to Frank Sinatra, and it was a very different dynamic. So I really had a difficult time understanding that dynamic with my friends' parents and how they behave. They're sort of hippie parents and cool and a bit more liberal, and my father was very, you need to do it this way, this way, this way. And now I'm older, I can appreciate what he meant, where he'd come from in his life. And I also had that softening of my mother's generation, but she passed very young. She passed when I was 21 and so I didn't really get the opportunity to grow up with her. But where do I see myself now? I think I'm a byproduct of my dad. Now I'm 50, the same age as when my mum passed. I can sort of reflect and sort of look inwardly and think, wow, I'm really, really lucky to have been brought up with a father that was very direct and at times very cautious and a mother that was more libertarian and more you can do anything, maybe, you know, chase your dreams. And so I had this really unique mix, which has really played into the career I had. I ended up becoming a sportsman, and I think from my dad I learned the discipline. When I said I want to be a professional sportsman, I defined what that meant. Professionalism to me meant making a living from sport. Otherwise, my dad was like, get a job. Life's not a holiday, you know? And when my mother would be like, no, enjoy yourself a bit more. And so I think I have that mix. And I think I've always carried that, which at times has been detrimental as life's changed. I can be quite direct and I don't mind confrontation in any way, shape or form, but I think that's got to me where I am. So how do I view myself? Lucky that I had amazing parents. Incredibly lucky that I grew up where I did in south of Sydney, and I was introduced to the sport of triathlon because I was inspired by the Olympic Games and by Sebastian Coe and English athletes, and, you know, watching them, I wanted to be an Olympian in that sense. And I just didn't have the leg speed to be that big a runner, and triathlon sort of fell into place. And because I grew up on the beach, I was a runner that could swim, which was a unique blend in the early days of triathlon. And then for triathlon to grow up the way it did and me to be a part of that growth was just absolute sheer luck. I could have done another sport and been nothing, but you know, how do I see myself today? Yeah, I'm fortunate, happy, and very content with where I am and where I'm going. And I like to continually set goals and push myself.
So that's interesting, because like the way I framed the question was in kind of the terms that people perhaps from the outside would define you, which is like athlete or businessman. But actually what you've talked about there is actually character, you as a person and your values. Is that actually how you kind of look at the world and how you look at other people as well?
Always been that way. And I think I was always, you know, misunderstood in that sense, because I was very, everyone throws that word passionate around, and it's probably beyond passion. I was very open to stating my intentions on anything. And that really came about from my father. Be direct, son. What do you want? You know, like there was no fluffing around with dad. You know, it was like, you do this. If you go to school, you give it 100%. If you're not going to do it, get out and get a job. It was very, and I liked that. And I was, when I came to sport, where suddenly you're thrust into a spotlight, things you say, people take literally, right? Mm-hmm. And I never realized the power of fame, not that I was hugely famous, but I mean, the power of your word and fame. And in those early days, prior to social media, you had relationships with editors and writers of magazines, and they really wrote the narrative on who you were and what you represented. And I used to always think I was misrepresented. You know, I got thrown, he's cocky or he's arrogant. They're the furthest things from what I am. I'm not in those, but I was very direct. I stated my intentions. I'm not here to lose. I want to win. And I couldn't understand when we sat at press conferences and, you know, all my friends that I went to college with were off making money, and this is my profession, and I'm going to sit there and not state that I want to win this thing, and there's 20 grand and I want to win it. And I just didn't understand that. And then I think the editors and that at the time used to write differently. So, you know, I'm much more comfortable in that character now. I don't feel like I need to hide or be something I'm not. I can be authentic. And, you know, in those early days of my career, I was always, how do I need to behave? Almost like an imposter syndrome. And I think it shapes athletes and it shapes people and pushes them in a direction that people want them to be. And you lose that authenticity. And I think I built confidence over the years as an athlete with my team, and I isolated myself a little bit, and I felt more and more confident to be me, state my intentions and be true to the values I stood by. And you know, my father was with me every step of the way. He wasn't one of those, you know, sporting fathers that yell and scream from the sideline, but after an event, he was very direct. Like, you know, and I still vividly recall an event, and I think I spoke about this recently in an interview. In 2006, you know, I was this world short course champion and the number one short course guy in the world. And it was a very different time pre-2000. And I thought I'd go and win the Ironman Hawaii, something that Christian Blumenfeld's just done like that. I thought I'd be the same. I hadn't lost a race for 3 years. I was world number one, ITU world champion or world triathlon champion. And I popped over to Ironman thinking I'd win it. I won my first one. And I found that event very, very difficult, you know. And I remember in 2006, I finished second in a really close race, and I ended up in the medical tent. I just had my second child. I hadn't won the race. I mean, my fourth attempt at the event, hadn't won it. I won everything else. I hadn't lost any race except Kona. And my father stood above me in the med tent with my second liter of IV going into me, going, son, you don't need this in your life, man. Like, I mean, if I've pushed you too hard, it was the first time my dad showed vulnerability and care. Well, not that he didn't hug me. He wasn't really a hugger, but he's like, you don't need this, son. Like, what are you doing? What are you chasing? He took some blame for what I was pushing. I said, Dad, I love this. You know, this is what I do. I've always loved this sport. I love defining my boundaries and pushing. And I said, triathlon, I've just connected with. And I know at times, Dad, you think that I've skipped out on life or a bluff life, or he called me the golden child, the man who never worked. I'm like, Dad, this is work, and I want to do this. And it was a great moment, but it was a connection between me and my dad where I understood for the first time in my life his concern was just represented differently.
Yeah.
You know, I grow from that, and I try to be like that with my kids. I try to be very direct.
That's interesting. Yeah, you've taken that into your parenting as well.
Because at the time when I was young, I'm like, when I grow up and have kids, I swear I'm not going to be like that, right? Yeah. And I'm probably a little softer, I'm a little more, but I am definitely, no, this is what I think, and this is what, you know, I'm your father, I'm your parent at the moment. This is the direction, you know, and when you're all in the shoe, you can choose that, because I think you take a lot from that. That structure and framework you put in as a kid just carry beyond your career. And I really attribute everything I've done and the way I think and the way I believe anything is possible And I know these are big buzzwords, right? But I honestly believe you can do anything. And that's why I think people go, oh, he's an entrepreneur. I'm like, no, I don't need to be told what you can't. Tell me how it is done. Like everyone said I could never be a pro triathlete or a world champion, could never win Kona. If I listened to the naysayers, I would, no, I was the only believer, right? So it's I found that in life. So I think, I really attribute that to my upbringing.
Well, that's really like fascinating. I think the character, and when you spoke about being feeling like you were misrepresented, because I think there's, I guess, with people who are in and around triathlon, there is a perception of you.
Yeah,
I would say the words brash, controversial, outspoken, and kind of certainly when you were racing, had a reputation for we'll do anything to win, to get under somebody's skin. How much of it was misrepresentation? How much of that was a deliberate performance because you were trying to almost play a character to win a race? And how much of it was actually what you felt like was you?
I think, I found triathlon, I grew up loving boxing. And I know a lot of people, it's a promoter's dream and they just say all this silly stuff. But I found triathlon very vanilla. And everyone, I'd sit in these press conferences and you'd hear athletes say, best of luck to everybody. I've tried the best I can. And dude, this is pro sport. What do you mean tried the best you can? This is not participation medals at the, we're at the top of the top of the top here. Surely you want to win. And so I was always taken aback when I was asked a question in a press conference and it's almost like they expected a vanilla answer. I'm going to do the best I can and I wish everyone the best. I'd be like, I think I'm going to win this thing. I've trained hard and, I know these guys pretty well. I don't think any of them beat me. Actually, none of them have beat me in the last 5 years. So why are they going to beat me today? How is that offensive? Mm. If you find it offensive, boo-hoo. That's how I thought of things. This is kill or be killed. And it sounds melodramatic, but I've got a finite amount of time to be at the top of this sport. And anybody who doesn't realize that, any athlete that thinks their ass is going to age like wine, is just stupid. That's on you. You own that when you retire and you'll see it. Millions of athletes retire. Oh, shoulda, woulda, coulda, shoulda. I never wanted to have that. And that was really driven into me by my father. He said, if you're not going to walk away from a career in banking, because I was working at Bankers Trust when I finished college, and I only left that because there's no money in banking.
More in triathlon.
More in triathlon. But that was my dad's. If you're going to do this, you do this properly. And that was always, if you're going to play football, you go to training and you honor the coach and you honor the team. Otherwise, get out. And that was how I was in triathlon. I got 10 years, or it ended up being longer, but I'm maximizing every racing opportunity. If you're offended by something I say, then that's on you, mate. Get out of the way. It's my time's this long and someone else is going to come and kick my ass. I don't know that's going to come. So at the moment, I'm going to milk it. And so, I used to get it used to bug me. I wish there was a social media around when I was younger or when I was racing, because you could have written the narrative yourself. A lot of the athletes get to do now. And, I used to ring up editors of magazines and abuse them, go, you're a dipshit, mate. You're a groupie, man. You're not even a journalist, So it created this, those stories went around I didn't jump into this, but I looked different to everyone else at the time, right? Everyone in America was blonde hair, blue eyed, I'm a Maori boy, dark skin, fat ass, and my only thing that I could do was work hard. I believed I worked harder than anybody. And we came out of that old Australian system with Brett Sutton and Australia was conquering the world and very, very disciplined, hard training. And that was sort of how we were brought up. Work, outwork everyone else, because talent is not going to get you there. And as Brett used to say to me, as our national coach, you're not talented, mate. And it used to get into your head. And I realized the power of being strong in your brain and believing in yourself and not being offended or affected by what others say. And I realized that could also be a power if you threw it back on yourself, on them. So I was very direct, very confident that I'd done work. But when I was at home with my wife before a major world championship or something, I was a nervous wreck. The people see behind the scenes, but I wanted things. I think I was obsessed with being the best in my time I could possibly be, and no matter what the consequence. I'm not here to make friends. I got enough friends. I got them from school and I don't really care if you don't like me, not my thing. It's where kill or be killed sort of mentality. And now I'm out of it. And it's quite ironic. You get out of the sport and you start moving into business and you apply that same mentality and that same – you just steamroll people. Like, I mean, people are very politically correct. Like, I mean, like, people want something but they don't actually say they want it. How am I supposed to know what you want if you don't tell me? And so I want that. And they go, oh, I want it too. I'm like, well, it's a race. And sort of straight away competition kicks in and may the best person get the role. And that's why I think in business I've always – I found – business very, very easy because I found people were living a charade and a mirage and very much about job preservation and thing. I was like, get out of the way. I'm taking that off you. Thank you. And people are like, oh, I didn't, you know, it's you almost people call it bullying to some degree, but it's not. It's sort of competition. You're not going to walk in there and take it. If there was a $10,000 in the room next door and we all knew about it and they had us $10,000. And no one walked in and got it and I went and picked it up. How can you be angry at me that I walked in there, picked it up, put it in my pocket? You had the chance to do it. That's how I viewed things. I'm like, that's on you, mate. Dumb you. And so I've always applied that in life. And I think that was how I lived my life in triathlon. I've got a really good group of friends that I took out of triathlon that were like-minded. And Reinhard Tissink, a South African guy, hard man. I really looked up to hard, disciplined men, you know, like that. And
like your dad.
Not my dad. And I look at it now as a 50-year-old and I look back and I realize I was looking in my peers the same characteristics as my father, because he was probably, you know, you start getting all deep in your psychology. He was probably my first idol, you know, my first
person you really wanted to impress.
I really wanted to be like, yeah. Impress. And I look for that in other men and other characters. And I say it to triathlon a lot. The one thing you learn when you go to war with someone in an endurance sport and marathon running or anything, you learn a lot about people's character. And there is a lot of tough, tough men. You can talk a big brash game, right? But when the bullshit's gone and you pin that number on and all the coaches and all the mirage is gone, you're going head to head with someone and you learn a lot about their character. In this long distance racing as well, whether their fight, who they are, and whether all that talk is horse shit. And that's what I used to say with me. Like, oh, I'm happy to be brash. But you got to back it up on race day. And I used to back it up. So I said, you can't deny it. Like, he's talking a big game. Yeah, but I won, mate. So I'm not talking a big game. I'm just telling you the facts. You're just denying the fact that they're the facts. I'm the best. Accept it or move on. If you bring the next one in, I'll kick his ass too. That was how I used to motivate myself and push myself. And I used to appreciate the ones I went to war with and the soft ones that would filter away. And it's definitely a byproduct of looking for the characteristics of my dad. I definitely see that now.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned earlier as well, like when you came into it, you sort of felt like, I look different to everybody else who's doing this sport, yeah. As well. Was that something that you think genuinely, like other people were actually thinking, or was it just a self-conscious thing, do you think?
It's a self-conscious thing. I think all athletes are very, very self-conscious. Mm. You know, you have this public persona that you try and be something, but you're the only person who knows all your weaknesses. Well, your insecurities, everything. But I did feel like we weren't poor by any means growing up, but we definitely, triathlon in Australia was upper middle class, Mossman. Like if you know Sydney, like Northern Beaches, on the harbour, Mossman, they had $10,000 bikes. My bike was $200. Like I had the shittest bike in transition. And that used to drive me. And my dad used to drive me. He's only this kid with his big trendy bike and his wheels and you can kick his ass, son. You know, like, I'll be like, oh, I'm going to, Dad. You know, like there was definitely a chip on my shoulder in a sense, and it used to feed me that, you know, I'm going to take that off you. You might have that, but that's mine. You might have all the bells and whistles, but that's mine. And that was what I loved about sport, that it didn't know socioeconomic backgrounds. It didn't know no matter where you're from, or whatever, you had to stand on that line and have a crack. And I could be equal or better than anyone in that. And I think that drive and that characteristic took me through, and I really lived off, you know, when you go through your junior years and that's sort of the motivation and what drives you, you don't lose that grit. You don't lose it and you don't appreciate. You never, you know, I definitely appreciated where I was coming from. I always knew that at any point in time this could end and I needed to make hay while the sun shined. And I often get frustrated with a lot of the young pros today. Like it's so easy and they're so soft with the utmost respect. I mean, they're absolutely highly talented, way more talented than us, but they're very soft and think things are going to last forever and suddenly it's over and they're like, oh, what happened? I'm like, dude, how did you not – do you not look at the history? Do you not, like, know yourself? It's just bizarre to me. It's almost like a stupidity that they just don't want to admit. like I said, your ass doesn't age like wine. It's vinegar, mate. Like, you, if you get past 35 and you're still milking this sport or any sport at any level, good on you. You've got a talent, but it's, there's a finite amount of time, and a lot of them leave it too late to transition out and start thinking of the future. A lot of kids think it's going to last forever, and any athlete you speak to knows that looking back, it's a blink of an eye, and it's what you implement early in your career, and then that shape what your career looks like at the end, both from an exit point of view, and I think a lot of the mental health issues that a lot of athletes have, because you know that they need the accolades, they need the fame becomes their world, and the lies and the people upping you all the time, and you need some real people in your corner, and that's what I always have with my father. My brothers always kept me very, very grounded. And I see that in the Brownlee boys. I think they both, Johnny and Alistair, you know, they're rock stars, man. Like, they're the greatest to do this short course racing, I believe, ever. And you see the way they bounce off each other, and they keep each other grounded, because when you start believing the hype, it's very, very easy to get your legs cut out from underneath you, and that starts a downward spiral and could be the end of your career.
Was it always the same? Because I wonder if when you look at that, you think probably guys who are less affected by that. You look at yourself, you mentioned the Brownlee boys, you think perhaps about a Jan Frodeno. Yeah. But these guys are all a bit older. They probably, in their formative years, they grew up, social media just, it wasn't a thing, exist. Whereas now, all the athletes that are kind of younger than that have grown up in this world of social media. Do you think in a way, like you said about setting their own narratives is a good thing, but do you think in a way it's affecting them in a different way, in a more negative way, in other areas of their careers?
I do. You're right. Because at times I think, oh, you're so lucky you have it. And other times I'm like, man, you need to get back to what it is you do. You need to work really, really hard. And yeah, you're spending all this time taking photos of yourself. And I don't know how I would, even if social media, I don't know how I would have handled it. What I liked about the Brownlees, and I didn't really appreciate, I guess, and you guys from the UK know this, like the toughness of the people from the north. And I remember watching Alistair Brownlee in the 2000s. I never heard of the kid. And I'm now Ironman world champion, old fart. And I knew some of the guys. And I watched that Beijing Olympics that Jan Frodeno won. I knew Jan, you know, I didn't think he was going to win. I thought Simon Whitfield would win it. But this 19-year-old kid, 19. People have short memories. 19 at an Olympic Games, running on the front, going for gold, right? And he blew up with 6K and everybody, you know, he went on to win. And I remember they were doing an interview on German TV. Next to him was the Australians. And I saw Alistair Brownlee in the background with his hand in his head, like visually disappointed he didn't win the Olympics. I'm like, who's that kid? Yeah, like, who is that kid? Like, what, I've never heard of him. How's he going to win? You could just see him almost in tears that he didn't win. And I remember thinking, wow. And then 2009, anyone who knows this, he went on a rampage and just ripped the legs off. And I loved it because Jan Frodeno is the Olympic champion. And as you learn in sport, a title doesn't mean shit. You need to stand up the next day and do it again. Like, if people are intimidated by your title, then that's on them. And Alistair Brownlee ripped his legs off, right? Just Olympic champ. And I loved it. I started tuning in because I'd never seen a kid so hard. And he rewrote the book, all the coaches that started coming in, and now all the refinement and all this tactical bullshit. He just, bring your swim tactics in, I'll rip those off. Bring your bike tactics in, I'll attack up the end and tear you apart. If you want to ride slow, I'll outrun you. Like, he just changed the game. And then I'm going to bring my younger brother with me because I think these are all pathetic and weak. And I just, he captivated me. That guy brought me back to short course racing and went, mate, that is where the sport's going. And if someone told me that sport could look that, our sport could be that good, that an athlete of that caliber could exist, because light years above the ability I ever had, I would have been all in on everything, not possible. And I think, you know, when you speak to Alistair now, we're very good friends, and it's, he had the same excuse as me. I wasn't that good. I got no talent. What I could do is outwork people and outmuscle them. I just believed I was stronger. And I'm like, and that's when you realize all the coaches, sure, there's talent, don't get me wrong, but it's a subconscious belief that you're better than someone, and you create an ego, or almost an alter ego, that becomes you in your own head, you know, that voice that talks to you. And that voice needs to be a believer, and you need to believe what you say. And you can't, you see those people that start, you see an athlete who loses that belief, they second guess that, and that voice changes. You see it in tennis a lot, big time in tennis, when they fall apart in a match, and it just unravels really quickly. And I And it's been meeting these other athletes as I've got older and listening to their stories and watching them as a fan and from afar with a bit of distance from the sport now, and I'm not racing them as a peer, where you start to you find the characteristics that you both share and you start to shape up what success means like and what success looks like and how you get successful and what are the characteristics of success. And a lot of the things you're led to believe, oh, you need to do this, you need to hit these numbers, you need to do these specific training sessions, yeah, they're part of the puzzle. But what separates the greats is a undenying hardness and belief that they're better than everyone and never get in the way of that. And once they lose that, it's over. And I believe to some degree Alistair's vulnerable now. He's been defeated, he's been beaten, he's had some issues, he's had some problems, he's tried to move to long course, it hasn't been as, and he's trying to go through that puzzle, because what's always worked in the past is not working now. So it's almost like you have to redefine yourself, and that takes a different characteristic that he's going to have to find in himself.
But I guess that's an interesting thing, because that's kind of the crux of the psychology of an athlete, but also then when you transition out, because you have to, obviously the way you've described it is you have to have this rock solid belief, this alter ego. But like how much does that actually start to take over who you are? Like in your own life, you bring it home, you take it to your family, and suddenly this character that you're kind of almost playing for success in a sporting arena starts to define who you are. And then when you stop, when the day comes you don't do this anymore, is that who you are for the rest of your life? Or do you find yourself again?
It's, you're absolutely right. It does become and I talk about this with my wife, because I now as an outsider, I see a lot of the athletes we work with. And I'm like, was I that painful? It's like, oh, you were worse. But you don't see it. And it's like, and you put people around me. A guy said to me once, and I remember he's like, oh, you only put people around you that tell you what you want to hear. I said, yeah, it's exactly what I do. Like, what's wrong with that? I don't need someone telling me, oh, you can't do that, mate. Like, so yeah, that's exactly what I look to find. So I put people in my life, and they were obscure characters. You know, Michael Gilliam, G, has been in my life forever. He's a very strange gentleman, right? I love him to death, like a brother from another mother. But he had a way of motivating me with single words. Like I'd be out on a course and he'd be like, see what they're doing there, Mac? They're applying pressure on that run. Control it. Not get excited, just... And I'll be like, you know, he just had these triggers that worked for me and I needed that. And he was so positive. He's such a believer in what I could do. But, yeah, you do create, you do start to lose yourself. And what a lot of people forget, and they don't give athletes, we're only young. Mm. When you're at the height of this fame and this, and you've been given these superpowers because you're young and for a short period of time, you're still evolving as a man or a human. You're still trying to understand who you are yourself. And then suddenly the world tells you who you are and this is how you're supposed to behave. And you're like, well, okay. And you go down, and then that can be detrimental to your character as a racer. And then you got to pull that back, and you have all these confusing moments because you're so young. And I wish I was my age now. And I could go back, and everyone says it, put an old head on young shoulders, and be as comfortable as I am in myself right now, and be the young athlete at 21. I'd kill people. Like, I mean, and I would have done it probably a different way, because I'm much more balanced, and I'm appreciative of my strengths and weaknesses, and I don't need to be as insecure as I was and be as brash and be that character to some degree, because I believe that character is like the Hulk. I needed that to come out of my skin in order to be a killer. And then, yeah, you have to tame it again and come back home, but you can't ever tame it too much. You need to bring it there, and it's quite exhausting and it's quite scary, because when it's not going well, you know, you're wondering if your Hulk has lost its superpowers, you know, whether you've still got it and whether you need to become something else. But it's definitely this fine balance. But as I said, when I left sport, I was always planning transitioning out of sport. Because my father was saying, when I was in the height of my career, what are you going to do after, son? Like, what are you going to do after? You need to start thinking of that. I'm like, so I was always thinking of, I was always investing in things and starting things. I started bike shops in the middle of my career in Australia, which we sold off. And, you know, I was always considering what I was going to do after it. But I really found when I got out of this hyper-competitive, you know, what do you call it, alpha male world of sport, and maybe I created that in my own head, that's how I saw it was, and they probably weren't as alpha as I actually thought they were, but I found when I moved into business, it was a lot, I could tame things down a bit and I could be a little more confident and back myself a little bit more and go, okay. And people always say, oh, how did you do that? I'm like, well, being an athlete was a risk. So being a risk taker is not you know, I left banking. I went against my father's wishes to be an athlete. That took, for me, a lot of courage. That's the most courageous thing I've ever done in my life. If you knew my dad, like, I mean, even my brothers are like, wow, you know. And, you know, it's so starting new businesses or having a go, I was always quite, I felt let down by my peers in sport that I had a lot of respect for, because I thought, you're the biggest risk takers. You're hard, tough guys that take a chance, and then you sort of get to the end and you start protecting everything you have and retreating into your skin. Oh, I don't want to do anything anymore. I'm like, why not? We're 35. Mm. Like, we're at the height of it. Let's go. Let's do things. And Super League's one of those things. I remember talking about Super League with my friend. I thought, oh, mate, can't happen. I'm like, hey, what makes you think you can do that? I'm like, well, someone's got to do it. I'm like, why not us? Like, let's do it. We know the sport. We know the players. We know our best racing. We know what athletes need. I'm doing it. And everyone used to laugh. And now people are like, oh, he did that. Or, you know, building centers in Thailand or running foundations for kids. And these are things that people are like, what? How can you do that? I'm like, well, why can't I? How could I ever win an Ironman? How could we ever win a race? It's a mindset. But as I said, I think I always thought a lot of my peers that I'd probably go on and work with after my career sort of let me down, because they sort of ran back to their homes and put a little money in the bank, and then they become a coach and that's it. You know, I'm like, wow, I saw so much more in you. Not there's anything wrong with being a coach, don't get me wrong, but I thought you could rule the world, man. Like, you could have been the president, you know, like you were just impressed me so much as an individual, and you've become this sheepish, complete opposite character to who you were. And that's where I often wonder, were they living their alter ego? And that's what I saw of them on the race course. But I do believe that alter ego is at the core of who you are.
You obviously talked a lot about your dad and his influence on you. You also mentioned earlier that you lost your mother at 21, which is quite a young age to lose a parent. Do you think perhaps the part of what fueled the Hulk, yeah, alter ego as well, was perhaps losing that softer influence in your life?
100%. And I didn't appreciate, now I have my own children and I'm at the same age today as my mother was when she passed, 50. And you get reflective, and I never knew my mum. She was mum, but now, you know, I didn't know her as a like, and I asked my aunties and that, what was she like? I want to know more about my mum, because she was only this. I just remember my mum as the most, as every boy thinks of their mother, I guess. She was just the voice of reason, the soft element. I felt a lot more closer to her in love, I guess, much more closer to her in being able to have a conversation and talk about where dad was direct. And I make my dad sound out like an ogre. He was not by any means an ogre, but I definitely missed that. My younger brother, who she was 18 when he passed his last year of school. Yeah, we talk about that a lot, because we didn't know her. Like, we knew her, but I would love to know who she was. And I hear the stories, and your mum was the coolest, and I hear it off all these older people. I'm like, wow, I wish I knew.
You missed that transition, I guess, from your parents being just your parents to becoming your friends.
Exactly. And I think had she been around in my career, she would have given me a lot more balance, and she would have helped me not be so scared as an athlete, not be so impatient as an athlete, to take time to reflect and be more strategic and clever. She was amazing. She was at every event I ever did as a schoolboy kid, as a runner. I miss that. And I didn't realize how much. And I remember when she passed at 50, you know, you're 21, you're like, oh, it's not a bad innings. You know, you think 50's old. I'm like, now you're there, you're like, wow. Like, and it's definitely a, and when she left, you know, she had three boys, right? So she was the only female influence in the, you know, the pack. And my younger brother's an animal. And my older brother was the, you know, we were definitely hardcore boys in that sense. My older brother ruled the roost. My younger brother was big married boy, 120 kilos. So he was big. So it wasn't long before he was 13, 14, could build us both. So then we'd, you know, there was this pack element of what do you call it? Testosterone, I guess. Yeah. She could come in and stop in an instant. Yeah. Boys, you know, like, and we just adored mum, you know. And I think I didn't truly appreciate that until now I'm older. And, you know, I was too obsessed with, okay, deal with it. You know, that was all around Sydney Olympics. Mum's passed. A lot of people's mums. I remember I was sponsored by Rexona at the time. I had a big TV commercial, Rexona TV commercial, and the guy from Rexona rang me and said, look, man, a lot of people, you got to get your head back in the game. A lot of people's mums had died. You know, you got to win the Olympics. 2 weeks after she died. Like, today you did that to an athlete, you'd be on the front page of the papers. Like, I mean, you know, and that's sort of, it was just a different time. I just felt like, oh, yeah, you're right. Suck it up. Get on with it. Never talk about it again. You know, like, you just don't talk about it. And then, yeah, you get dropped from teams because they don't think your head's right. But I just didn't have – I didn't have that network around me that a lot of the athletes do now, and I do appreciate that. But again, how would I have handled it? I can only look at my career from the way it went, and would it have killed off something? I don't know. I was happy with how things went, but I definitely feel I missed some of those things with her not being around.
Yeah, for sure. And then I guess, like, if we move kind of through to what you were talking about there about triathlon, keen to get back onto like how you've. Because what's also interesting, I think, is you had a career before you became an athlete. You're obviously super intelligent, driven. You've got all the qualities we talked about that you've brought into your business career. You could easily have just left triathlon behind and potentially have gone on and made more money, frankly, because triathlon is not a money-laden sport. What is it that's kept you wanting to form like businesses, enterprises around this sport still, even though you could have moved on quite easily?
I loved it. And I guess when you compare it to modern era to now, I loved sports stars. Sebastian Coe, the World Athletics president, I just spent some time with him in Hungary at the World Athletics this week, was my absolute sporting idol. Like, I mean, and I tell people, a lot of people, Seb Coe, you know, I said, hey, man, I remember watching him at the Olympics going, that is who I want to be. I so wanted to be, I didn't want the fame. I wanted to feel what that felt like to run across the finish line with the Olympic champ, 3:32:53 when he won in 84. And he came out to Australia in 1990, right? So I was 17, 18 years of age. And he was trying to qualify for the Commonwealth Games, which were in Auckland, New Zealand. And he came to a track and he was training at the track that we trained at. And I had a big video camera that I heard he was at the track from the night. We kept going down until he was there. And I walked over to him. Now he's the Olympic champion, mate. Like, I mean, my absolute idol. I've only ever seen on a television screen on VHS videos, for those who used to have videos back in the day. He gave me an hour of his time, a young punk of a kid. And I realized an athlete of that caliber can influence a young person so much by their behavior, right? Mm. And he was just an absolute gem. I'll defend that man until the day I die. And I wanted to be that. And I found that in triathlon. I found the feeling, I found my peer group and friends, I found the challenges and the discipline I want, I found all the things I used to watch on those things that I used to watch Sebastian Coe with his dad training. I want to be like that. I want to do 20 intervals. He does 9 and I'm going to do 20. I was just connected by that. And I think the younger generation, or my older generation, because we didn't have so much fast media, you held on to things a lot longer, right? Mm. Like your idols you held on to. Like I wanted to be like them. Nowadays, everyone forgets everybody. Like, I can't even tell you who won, and no one sort of hangs on to anything. It's just in an instant and gone. So I think they lose this underlying passion and grit. But I love triathlon. I think it's a really, really cool sport. I think it tests the endurance and the skill level of humans across three Olympic sports, which is really cool. And I feel like indebted to it. It gave me my life. Like, I gave up my life to do this, like, you know, and within our family, as I keep saying, my father and brothers are like, oh, what are you doing triathlon? And I tell the young guys today, it's like telling you, when I became a pro, it'd be like telling your father, I want to become a professional Spartan athlete today. You're like, what? Yeah. Spartan? Like, isn't that just for people jumping over? Because it wasn't really taken seriously. You know, we weren't in the Olympics yet, you know, 93. I came across in 1990, 93 with Junior Worlds, and we 94, Sydney won the Olympics. 95, we announced we're going to the games in triathlon first. Like, the Olympics legitimized this sport, right? And it took a lot from it, but it legitimized it. And I just, to me, that made me feel like I'd be like a Sebastian Coe. So I think to some degree, the influence a hero can have on a young boy's life or a young person's life is immense. And the responsibility athletes have that they don't realize on influencing people is enormous. And I always believed I had a responsibility in that sense. So when I left the sport, I said, I want to do something. I want to leave it better, a better place than when I had it, because I was lucky to see it evolve. A lot of these kids only know the sport as a federated sport with Olympic Games and funding and lotto funding, and I'm going to sit down and sponsor, gimme, gimme, gimme. Like, it didn't used to look like that, you know, and I believed it can keep going, you know, because I've only known triathlon to grow, and it's sort of plateaued, right? Is this as big as it can get? Maybe I'm wrong, but I've always believed that it has the potential to be huge. You know, the participation's there, but I've thought from a professional level, because the athleticism is there. The characters are there if they're let to thing. The racing and skill set's there now, and why can't it be big? And so I, you know, that's why I give my life to this sport. I love it. At times I don't know why. I'm like, wow, I quit. You know, I can't do this. But it's just quitting's not in my headspace. I'm like, no, I'll come back. I've got to keep pushing. So
interesting parallel though. Seb Coe, having gone on and had a very successful career, obviously he's maybe influencing athletics, but kind of from more of a, yes, I guess, a political standpoint in many ways, and you're influencing triathlon, but in your way, it's kind of, yeah, with Super League, I guess, and with your Bahrain team, it's ripping up what's been before and trying to create something new.
Yeah, just, you know, trying to be different, like trying to, I felt that coming at the business side of triathlon, you know, when I left triathlon, I said, I'm going to go, I don't know, be a computer coder and invent some, well, I'm useless on a computer, so why would I do that? But I know this sport and I know the sports world very well. I had a good network within it. I understood the dynamics of marketing and promotion to some degree. Obviously, you can get a lot smarter people around you. And I always believed, like I was in sport, build a team, empower them, lead them. Like, empowerment doesn't just mean, hey, you do that, you do that, you do that, I'll come see you in a couple of months. You definitely have to set a direction and have them buy into the belief. In the same way I said, I always put people around me that believed.
Mm.
They need to believe that this is possible. So I love what Seb's done. Seb's a lot, I found Sebastian Coe much more articulate than I was. He's a conservative, he's much more of a politician. He's an incredible leader. But, you know, people attack him. I remember in Hungary, Seb got voted again, you got all the people. I'm like, because he's the best, mate, for the job. Like, if he wasn't, yeah, but he's too political. I'm like, yeah, but he was a great athlete too, mate. He won 2 Olympics, 2 golds, 2 silvers, comm golds, 5 European championships, 8 world records. Like, what else do you want from a man to lead the sport? Or you think you think you can do better? What did you do, mate? Like, I mean, give me, nothing. Exactly. Piss off. You're just a voice. You're just a noise. You're a talking head. And that's how I always believed in triathlon. I could come with a lot. And I must admit, when I entered the triathlon, I was quite naive when we started Super League and coming in with money from Bahrain. And I thought people would welcome us with open arms. Okay, he's a guy that's knows a bit about it, throwing money back and doing something, putting his money where his mouth is. But you don't realize I've got to be a little bit more political, and there's a lot of stuff that happens behind the scenes that people aren't aware of, especially as an athlete. And growing any enterprise is, you know, can be 3 steps forward, 1 step back. 2 steps forward, 2 steps back. You know, it's like solving a puzzle and, you know, managing people and having people, you know, it's very difficult. You work with us. It's a tough game, but it's without a challenge in life. What have you got? What else would I be doing? I said, go and sit on the farm in Australia and watch my cows. No, I love this stuff. I enjoy the whole challenge of trying to do things that people think is impossible. You know, it just motivates me.
Is the evolution of the sport, like bringing in this change, is it happened as you expected, or does it take longer than you think it would take? And what's kind of, I'm wondering, like, as well, like, there's a lot of questions when you look at Super League, you look at the PTO and you look at everything that's going on around the sport. There's a lot of questions about, is this commercially sustainable? Is it financially sustainable? Like, you've got some wealthy backers that are backing this because they believe it will be, but this is probably the moment, right? Because if it doesn't work with these guys backing it, who's going to back it in the future?
You got to question the sport then, don't you? And that's where at times you do question. It's like an athlete questioning where they are in their career. Do I still have it?
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. Like, at times I question this triathlon, my love of triathlon and my love of the athletes who do it and the size of the sport. Is it big enough to be sustainable as a professional sport? Or is it always just going to fit under a federated model at Olympics? Kids come through a program for a high performance, go to the Olympic Games, bang, 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 and then off they go. And most Olympic sports, like a lot of triathletes, you need to ask yourself, God, you're a rower, you're one of the best rowers in the world. You ain't making a lot of money.
Mm.
If you're a netball, you ain't making a lot of money. You know, like you're just a federated sport. And does triathlon have the momentum and the entertainment value to be a professional sport as these other more established professional sports take more and more of the pie? It's quite interesting when you hear people go, oh, cricket just got $2 billion in TV revenue. And I'm always like, well, we should be shitting ourselves when that happens, because when these big established sports take more and more of the pie, it's not the pie getting bigger, the pie's actually getting smaller and they're taking more of it, which means they're going to rob it from us. So how do we constantly be disruptive or question ourselves? I think at times it's like training for an Ironman or training for an event, you can get tired and you just get into the mundane routine of doing the same thing, so that you never step back, reflect and go, maybe we need to pivot that way.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and the evolution of the teams in Super League was one of those pivots, right? It's like, maybe we need to go this way, franchise it, look at what other sports are doing. And of course, the traditionalists will go, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. And but you need to make tweaks and changes. But you're absolutely right. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, right? Like, but I still believe it can work. I see this as like my Ironman journey in Kona. Like, after the third year, I'd failed, and people are like, maybe you should get back to short course, mate. You know, and I said this to Ali, maybe. And I'm like, nah, because it wasn't working. But I changed things, put a bit of weight on, didn't try and get so skinny, and things went right. You know, and that's, you got to have the courage to be prepared to change, which can be hard. What makes, you know, startups and anything like this very difficult is other people, as you bring investors in and partner, you have sponsors and you have staff and other things, your flexibility gets more or less and less, more and more limited. So where before you can just go bang, now it's like turning a big ship. And that's what was your advantage becomes, you start to nullify the advantage that you had in the marketplace. And that's where at times I do think, you know, we need to keep that pliability. We need to be able to pivot and change. We need to be honest with ourselves. And, you know, you can, like I said, your alter ego, we can portray it, you know, as Super League's massive. We're the man. We're the best. But when you go back to your house with your crew, be vulnerable, you know, like be honest, right? And don't, we don't need to pretend in that space, because we're the group that are going out there to build it. So I'm still a believer in what we do. I still think Super League is the future of racing triathlon. I think, you know, I'm in Australia, you know, since COVID I moved back to Australia and I've seen the quagmire that is Australian triathlon. There's nothing there anymore. But every single kid, I sponsor a series now in Australia with our own capital, building up the next generation of Aussie kids called the Billigent Series. And every single one of those kids, they want to do Super League. That's all they want to do. It's the only event they're watching. They're not watching Ironman like I did. Then triathlon, they watch a bit of the World Cup, but they got to pay to watch that. And Super League's everywhere. And they're like, oh, I want to do Super League series. I'm like, how do I get in? And these are the, sometimes I think, okay, how, as a corporation, as a company, how do we talk to that generation, not just from an entertainment point of view, but a pathways point of view, on how do they get in? Because when they, Chris, how do I get into Super League? I don't have an answer for that.
Yeah.
You know, oh, well, pick you.
Get really good.
Yeah, we're really good and we pick you. You know, like, so we need to sometimes understand the responsibility we have outside of trying to build a professional empire, but understand the responsibility we have to the next generation. Because if you kill them off and no one wants to do it, you're just setting yourself up for down the track to fail, right? So, and I know the product works, because I hear the kids. They want to do enduros. I hear the words that the formats we created, they use. Eliminators. I'm like, dude, we made that up. You know, it's cool. Short shoots. They're doing this. And I'm like, dude, it's a Super League. You know, like, so it resonates with the audience we want it to resonate with. And so I just know we just need to stay committed to the drive, keep pushing, and I think this is the future.
You've taken up a lot of your time already, Chris. It's been fascinating talking to you. But I guess to wrap up, I guess, do you think you could ever, like with all this, do you think you could ever walk away from triathlon? Is it going to be in you forever?
No, I think I'll always follow it. Like I'll always follow triathlon. I'm trying to do a little bit more in athletics now, without question, and because it's my other love, and I'd like to do a bit in surfing. But the Phoenix Foundation that we've started gives us a lot of opportunity to do that, and bringing young kids along, and I'm really being empowered by the passion of young kids. Because I guess as you get older, sometimes I feel like I'm my dad. I'm like dictating, going, oh, you kids have got nothing in there. Yeah, you're soft. That's what my dad did to me. But then when you work with these young kids and you see their passion and their desire and their drive and they're just confused. It was a lot more traditional when we were young. Bang, you do this, and you're in. Now there's just so much to do and there's, you know, you see it still there. I feel there is a desire for kids to continue to do sport, and that keeps me motivated. Will I walk away from triathlon? I'll always be involved in it, and I always love it, and I'm always tuning in. I've been watching the Ironman World Championships, 70.3 World Championships today. I swore I wouldn't, but I can't help myself. and yeah, obviously Super League racing. I follow it. I'm probably not as overly, I'm not as connected like I used to be. 10 years ago, if someone lost a race, I'd lose my shit, you know, like, because I wanted it so much. Now I can be a little bit more, oh, don't worry, there's another one coming. You realize it's not as big as you think it is. But I think there's a lot of people like yourself and the people that work with us, Super League, and a lot of the people that come out and watch the events, a lot of the young kids that are doing it, a lot of the athletes that are here, you know, we owe it to them. Like, it's, you know, it's a hard, any journey's hard, but it's really cool when you, like I said, when I saw Sebastian Coe do 3:32.53 to win the Los Angeles Olympic Games, I said, I want to be you. I didn't want to be you. I want to have that feeling. You get the same feeling when you're retired from sport, from kicking ass in this. And if Super League makes it, that feeling we all share, and that'd be pretty cool as, you know, to stand back one day and go, wow, you know, it does work. Super League is worthy. And working doesn't need to be, a lot of people, that's the other thing I want to say. A lot of people go, oh, you know, you walk into these meetings with sponsors and that, and they're like, Premier League football. I'm like, mate, we're not going to be Premier League football. Like, let's start it. Let's go surfing. Yeah, you know, let's start at a sport. I'd be happy if we're as big as surfing, right? And, you know, people go, oh, surfing loses money. I'm like, yeah, but a surfer, like these pro surfers, I can tell you what the pros make. I can tell you their engagement on social media. I can tell you what the YouTube channels are making. That is a sport that's wide. It's federated to some degree, but there's a lot of people making a lot of money, and that is a professional sport. And that's what I always say. Professionalism for me is for an athlete to be able to make a living, not just to survive, to make a living that lasts their career and gives them a margin of error post their career to redefine, give them time to find something else to do. And professional athletes at the moment in triathlon are few and far between. There was a lot more of them back when I was racing, and I think it's our duty to change that. And if we could get that to surfing, where there's 100 surfers making a lot of money, and money that, well, actually when they retire, they can just keep surfing, right? Like, yeah, that's to me a profession, you know. And we got to look at what profession is. If you're an accountant, you're at that forever, and we have a 10-year, my dad used to say to me, son, you have 10 years in this sport. If you stayed in finance, you would have had a 40-year career. So at minimum, you need to make 5 times the amount of money you were making as a banker in triathlon, otherwise you're a failure, mate. And that's how he viewed things. So I was like, oh, okay, so if a banker makes 200 grand a year, I need to make a million. And that was how my mind worked. All right, and then I'd be chasing races. And I try and tell that to the young kids today. They're like, you're mad. I'm like, well, you need this margin of error. So that's, to me, professionalism.
Brilliant. Chris, thanks so much for your time. It's been fascinating to speak to you like this. And, yeah, we wish you, and of course, Super League,
yeah,
and everything you do, all the best going forward. Cheers. Thank you.
Too easy.